Welcome everyone to Talking Shop Down Under. This is your host, Richard Banks. Welcome again to yet another awesome episode. And I have with me, since I'm back from holidays, he decided to hang around. He was still in the studio when I came back, Mr. David Chipback. David, how are you?
Hi, Richard. Welcome back.
Thanks, mate. How's things?
Yeah, all right. Not too bad.
Excellent. And now the trick is you're not actually the guest. So we're not just doing a little thing where you interview me, I interview you, and then we just get all circular and get confused.
Oh, I thought that worked pretty well last time.
We've got a guest. Mr. Thomas Johansson. In fact.
Hello, hello.
There he is. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
So,
glad to be on your show.
Oh, we're glad to have you. I have this little warmth in my soul just hearing your voice. Now, you don't have an Aussie accent.
Nope, I don't.
I'm quick on those pickups, aren't I?
Oh, yeah. You're pretty good.
So you're from New Zealand?
Well, maybe. Maybe a bit further north, you know. I'm from Norway. Yeah, Fiji. No, I'm originally from Norway, but I've been to Australia in the past. Did my bachelor's degree in Brisbane a few years back. Then I thought I was tired of Australia and moved back to Norway. And now I'm back again.
Because you realize Norway's cold.
Yeah, exactly. A lot more snow than I remembered, basically.
Is that one of those memory makes the heart, you know, one?
Yeah.
What am
exactly.
I'm confusing my statements there, but anyway, that's fine.
Yeah, I knew what it meant.
Hey, out of curiosity, have you been to NDC at all?
Yes, I have. The first.
NDC, by the way, for those who don't know, is what?
Norwegian Developer Conference. So it's basically a part Microsoft Tech conference and part, you know, Agile, Scrum, a bit like, you know, alt.NET, basically. We'll wrap up in a 3-day conference.
So is it as good as we hear? Because you hear things from, you know, various people that go or talk about it, and they just say, oh, NDC is the bomb, it's the shiz, it's where you got to go, it's, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, I think it's really good because it's about Microsoft Tech, but it's not by Microsoft. They are sort of part of the process. But you get a view sort of from outside on Microsoft Tech from people that, you know, work with it, not just that sort of develop the frameworks. So it's more, a bit more real world, perhaps is a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And then with a bit of, you know, Agile, and we've had Lean as well from Mary Poppendick.
Oh, nice.
It's really good because you get all these different, you know, type of presenters in one huge big conference, and it's a blast, basically. It's really, really good. So I've went the first 3 years, and seems like I'm going back this year as well.
Oh, excellent. So you're going to have to give us a bit of a report post-conference.
Yeah, definitely. You can do that.
All right. So that aside, NDC aside, what have you been doing lately? Just for those who don't know you.
Yeah, so I work at Redify. I'm a senior developer and work mostly with ASP.NET and mostly focused on the front end side of it. So, you know, HTML, CSS, a bit of user experience and all that good stuff. And that's sort of my daytime gig. Then, you know, my nighttime sort of evenings are mostly Ruby. Node.js, a bit of CoffeeScript lately as well, for those that know what that is. For those that don't, it's basically JavaScript, a bit more functional. So it compiles into JavaScript, but it's, you know, a bit more functional. So it has list comprehensions and things like that.
So it compiles into JavaScript. So you compile into a dynamic language.
So you write CoffeeScript and then you basically transform it into JavaScript, but it's a two-way process. You can also take JavaScript and turn it into CoffeeScript. So they're, you know, completely compatible languages.
Did I hear correctly that CoffeeScript's shipping with a new Rails version or something? Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So in Rails 3.1 with the new asset pipeline, We'll have CoffeeScript by default and SAS. And SAS, for those that don't know that, is basically a extension language on top of CSS. So it gives you nesting, for instance. So instead of being very expressive with your rules, you can then just instead nest them so they map directly against your DOM. And it supports things like your mixins, variables, things that people have sort of been wanting in CSS for quite a few years.
Sorry, what do you mean by mixins in CSS?
Right, so let's say you often do rounded corners or some such thing. Probably know these days you have to target different browsers for that because it's CSS 3, so not all the browsers have it yet. So officially it's border.radius, but you know, let's say you're using Firefox, that would be with the vendor prefix hyphen MOZ.
Mm-hmm.
And same here for WebKit and all those browsers. So what you can do within a mixin is you can have a sort of a function. So you can then specify that the default corner rounding is like, for instance, 5 pixels. And then inside of that, you would then have all the different border radius versions with the vendor prefixes. And whenever you want to use that, add border rounded corners to any of your elements, mm-hmm. we then just reference the mixin. So in SAS, that would be include and the name of your mixin, and then optionally then overriding the params on the mixin. So instead of 5 pixels, you could then make it 15 or something like that. So it's basically just applying your functions to JavaScript, so making it more dry, less copy-paste.
Sorry, functions to JavaScript or functions to CSS?
CSS.
Which is a bizarre concept since CSS doesn't have any programming concepts at all,
other than
I suppose the rules around waiting and stuff.
Yeah, so CSS, when it was made, wasn't really, I guess, carefully designed for the kind of sites and complex styles that we have these days, so...
I don't know why their 20 years forward vision didn't work so well.
Exactly. So, in their defense, I guess it was hard for them to sort of envision how far it would go. So instead of waiting for a new, more scriptable CSS, people have gone and created a sort of an extension on top of it, which in this sense of CoffeeScript is something you convert into CSS. So you end up with normal CSS. You just don't have to type it. You don't have to be that expressive all the time. So it's easier to read and maintain.
So there's a generator step in between. You've got to run something beforehand, or is it done on the fly, or how do you get from SAS to CSS and from CoffeeScript to JavaScript?
Well, both of them actually does support being in process, but the common recommendation is to convert them. So with the Rails asset pipeline, you don't really have to do that. Then it's done on the fly and cached and all that fancy stuff for you. If you don't want to use that or you're not using Rails, both support the concept of a watch. So basically you start a process that watches either a single CoffeeScript or SAS file or a full directory. And then when any file changes within the directory or the single file changes, it'll generate the output for you.
So that's just a server-side thing that runs while the app's going?
Well, it could be, but the way I do it, and I guess most people do it, is a client-side thing. So you're sitting there and you're developing, you're writing your SAS scripts, SAS files. We then just basically start a watch on it. So you don't have to keep running the transformation. So it just runs in the background, and any time you save the file, it generates the CSS output for you.
Okay. So why would I use something like SAS instead of just sticking with CSS straight up?
Well, if you have a reasonably complex CSS style sheet, you might have the same kind of theme colors being repeated around the place. So instead, I guess, then of doing find replace, you can then change a single variable for changing all the colors. And it has things like color functions as well. So if you have a single theme color, but maybe your links are the same color but slightly darker or has a different hue or something like that, you can actually apply color transformations to that. So that it basically means changing less lines of CSS if you want to transform colors and things like that.
And if you've got the same color used for two things because you've got the variables there, you're not going to do a global search and replace.
Yeah, exactly, because then you can be more semantic. So you would have your brand color, Maybe you have a concept of an aside background color and things like that.
So in terms of CSS transforms, there's also a thing called LessAround that does a similar sort of thing and that's usable in the .NET world.
Yes, definitely.
How does that compare? What's the difference between the two?
Well, they're very similar. The biggest difference is just the syntax they've both landed on. SAS sort of extends CSS a bit more than Less does. Less reuses. So for mixins in SAS, they're prefixed with at mixin. But in Less, they're just dots and then the name of your mixin name. So they basically look like CSS class selectors.
Oh, so you like Hungarian notation in your CSS?
Well, sort of. More like in CSS, you have import, right? So that's at import, and you have at media.
Yep.
So SAS sort of builds onto that concept of at, and then a keyword being something special. Whereas in Less, it's sometimes a bit difficult to see if something is a mixin or it's actually a class.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, I prefer the SAS route just because it uses more distinct principles like concepts. But at the end of the day, for the common things like variables, mixins, and nested scoping and so on, it work the same.
So with Less, you can use it in .NET, obviously, with the NLess, I think it is, or something.
Yeah, .less.
.less, that one.
Yeah.
Is there a dot or an NSAS or something like that floating around, or how does...
Nope, not yet. I am contemplating starting on a port for it, mostly for selfish reasons. We, the current project I'm on at Redify, we use Less,
mm-hmm.
but I keep hitting like small little issues with, .less in particular. It's not a complete port. So I'm sort of, contemplating porting SAS so we could use that instead. One of the big issues we're having, well, not big issues, but is the concept of from within a selector, you can reference the actual selector, so sort of a this, if you will. And in Less, you're limited to where, like, how you can use that. It's, and that this is an ampersand. You can only have that at the beginning of a sub selector. So we have ampersand space dot another selector. But in SAS, you can have that at any place. So if you have, for instance, then your i7 overrides or something like that, you can do that from within the selector for your a side element, for instance, instead of having to have a separate IE7 selector on the outside and then repeating your A side selector inside that. I guess it's a bit complex to explain, but there are some different compile time differences.
Right. So, what's the benefit of porting SAS to .NET instead of maybe just calling it from a post build script or something, the Ruby one, and generating your CSS on the just a build time for ASP.NET stuff?
Well, I guess the biggest advantage is if you go the same route as you can currently with .less, because it has a Visual Studio extension called Chirpy, which does this at sort of save time within Visual Studio. So it just you have a better development experience. So doing that with Ruby from within Visual Studio, you can always do that. I just guess from my opinion, it would be easier if it was a .NET component, just added it to a NuGet. And if you have Visual Studio, you already got the .NET framework. So there's just less things to install.
I noticed on your tweet stream that IronRuby wasn't working for you when you were trying to run SAS via IronRuby.
Yeah, so it turns out the most likely issue there is the fact IronRuby's regex support isn't compatible with MRI, with like Matz's Ruby interpreter. So it just basically doesn't work. So until the regex support in IronRuby is compatible, it won't run, which was a big letdown for me because I was hoping to run the official SAS test suite against my port so that I can sort of guarantee that my port was complete.
Right.
So right now it looks like I'm going to have to start porting the test suite as well. Yeah, so it's over 1,000 tests and something around 5,000 assertions. So yeah, that's going to be fun.
It might be easier just to fix up the regex work in.
Exactly. So I've been looking at the code. Might be something I look into over Easter as a fun little experiment to see if I can fix it. Or at least make headway, I guess.
Or one of the listeners can just chip in with a fix for you.
Even better.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit. And Dave, do you want to ask anything about Rails in particular?
Well, one thing, there's been a bit of discussion on the old.NET Oz mailing list about Ruby and people going from .NET to Ruby and the normal sort of flame wars that go on. What's your take on that? When would you choose Ruby and Rails over ASP.NET and MVC?
Well, yep, the simple answer, I guess, would be if, well, depending on the team, if there is a team. So if nobody knows Ruby, but they know .NET, you know, go the Ruby route. But yeah, the cop out. For personal projects these days, I pretty much default to Ruby and Rails if it's something web related. I feel like I fight the framework less when I do Ruby. I can focus more on the actual things I want to do. If I hit a problem, I don't have to wait for a solution or a new feature in the framework. I can just add it to Ruby at runtime.
Have you ever done that?
Oh, yeah, I have. And it's something that Rails does all the time, which is why it could never really have existed on top of a different language than Ruby, because they change quite a bit, and that's sort of why it works as well as it does. It's simple things, but all the routing and all that is basically built on top of the method missing and so on. So there's all these really powerful metaprogramming principles in Ruby that allow you to basically change absolutely anything.
So I've noticed that the abstractions used for Ruby code seem to be a bit different to the compared C# abstractions. So one thing I've noticed just browsing through Ruby code is you'll get lots of self-contained modules that may have quite a bit of code shoved in them, but they're sort of very independent and cohesive in their own. They stand alone, whereas the C# ones I see seem to have very few lines of code per class, but you end up walking through it quite a large tree of abstraction. So you get in a factory creating a processor, creating a command registry that returns commands from a repository, and you end up sort of 10 levels deep in abstractions and wondering where you're going. I'm wondering, is that something to do with the language and the idea that you can do mix-ins and metaprogramming and all that, or is it just sort of a stylistic thing within the Ruby community?
Well, I think it's probably a bit of both. I mean, there's nothing stopping you from basically mimicking C# if you wanted to do that. I think just most people find that it's often not necessary to have that level of abstraction. Yeah, most Ruby projects I've written and worked on, they're fairly small. So if you find that you suddenly need some kind of, call it an inversion of control, which you don't really need in Ruby, but then you can just add that. I think people sort of landed on a perhaps a bit more pragmatic path, where not everything has to have an interface and be, as you said, like 10 levels deep of abstraction. It's mostly focused on getting things to work, which can lead to big, ugly classes. So but you see both good and bad. Not everything in the Ruby world is perfect, but people, I guess, try to find the sort of pragmatic middle part, like the golden sweet spot.
So you're basically saying you can write bad code in any language.
Yeah, odd, eh?
Amazing.
Who would have thought bad developers wrote bad code in any language?
I know, I'm flabbergasted myself.
Yeah.
I'm just as well I'm sitting down.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, none of the listeners would ever write bad code.
Oh, no, of course not. Of course not. They pretty much wrote perfect code, right?
All the time, and no one ever looks at their code in 6 months and...
Yeah, exactly.
What the hell was I thinking at the time?
Yeah.
All right, so some of the other things we were going to talk about, a little bit of HTML5, because it is the big buzz at the moment. Everyone's going, five, we love five, or because there's a video tag, apparently.
Yeah.
So
and audio as well, I believe.
There is
video in the browser. You can.
Oh, oh yeah, no. It's magic. It's magic. Witchcraft.
Because I do a lot of that myself personally. That said, there are other things in HTML5, obviously. What's your take on the stuff that's in there, and you know, what are you most excited about?
Well, if you look at the like stuff that's purely HTML5, not the APIs, which some argue are not actually part of the HTML5, they're just, you know, additional specs.
So the APIs, just for clarity, we're talking about what, WebSockets, for instance?
Yeah, WebSockets, the offline storage, what else? Well, I guess geolocation is part of it.
So all the things that aren't pure markup, basically.
Yeah, basically. And to a certain extent, like, yeah, the different storage scenarios and things like that, which, you know, they used to be covered in the spec, but most of them have been extracted into different specs because they slow down the rest of it, I guess, especially the video and audio stuff, because people basically can't make up their minds, you know, to what codec to use.
Yeah, let's use the commercial codec. Good move.
Yeah, exactly, which has patent government on it and whatnot. Yeah, no, but if you look at the purely semantic part of it, the actual markup, I'm really excited that we've finally got, you know, basically more semantic tags. So sections, header elements, a side, footer, your H group and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the section one is probably one of the most overlooked ones. People use it, but they still do things like, so let's say you have an H1 at the top level of your root level in your body tag. So you have the main title of your page. Then, you know, people know that, you know, because of page layout, you're not supposed to have any more of those. The next level then is H2, H3, and so on. But as soon as you use a section, you reset that flow. So then you could start using H1s again and H2s. So it sort of removes all that, you know, guessing that, okay, what HX do I need now? What level am I on? Especially if you're doing a dynamic HTML, that will obviously, you know, cause a bit of confusion. So then usually people just fall down to H5 or H6 just to be sure they're using an appropriate level of header nesting. But yeah, so, you know, you start using sections, you reset that, and it will actually, modern browsers will adhere to that as well, and especially screen readers. It makes sense for them. I guess many people don't even know this, but yeah, there is tools out there that can visualize the, yeah, basically a table of contents of your HTML document that gives you the outline of it.
What, just using the H tags?
Yeah. So it's the same concept as in, you know, Microsoft Word or any of those text processors. If you use them appropriately, you can generate your table of contents, which is nested and sort of grouped properly. You know, many people, I guess, don't even know that, but those of us that care about that, the section tag is a big help. And it also helps you group your content as well. So it's, yeah, from the semantic perspective, then instead of using, you know, tons of divs with IDs and classes on it, you can then use sections instead.
So how does that work for older browsers?
Well, that's the cool thing. So for all the browsers except IE6, they work out of the box.
It's not a browser.
Yeah, exactly. We shouldn't even mention its name at this point.
Unsupported. Move on.
Yeah. So they're all supported. They're not styled appropriately in older browsers, so especially but IE7, IE8. So you will need a bit of, you know, HTML reset usually, and a good place to find that is Eric Meyer's Reset CSS. But yeah, you can still get it to work in IE6. And it's a very easy hack, it turns out. You basically just use the JavaScript DOM manipulation method, create element. So if you do document.create element on a section, from that point on, IE actually then, you know, supports the section tag. It doesn't ignore it. It considers it to be proper markup. So yeah, thank you, Microsoft, for having that bug in there, which actually allows us to do HTML5 even in, well, parts of it in IE6 as well. Now, it won't do, well, you know, work properly with H1s within the section tags and so on. But yeah, I guess, you know, who cares about IE6?
Chinese.
Yes, the pirates, basically.
The pirates do.
Yeah, because it's still around, like, globally 35% or something, yeah. Which is, it's beyond me. It makes me a bit sad, yeah. But oh well.
Such is life.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
We don't need to worry about supporting them, though.
Yeah, no, even clients have that worked with started dropping support for it, which is a really good sign.
And we're talking about big corporate clients
here,
aren't
we? Corporate clients, yeah.
Yeah, long last.
Exactly, it just feels so good. We'll still have to suffer with IE7, but and partly IE8, but you know they're a lot better. A lot less hacks necessary.
I was wondering the mixed announcements of IE10. Anything exciting that you took out of that, or just more of the same?
Oh, I mean, it's exciting, I guess, that they're doing a lot of native performance, you know, tuning. Especially for things like CSS transformations, so like animations and things like that. The canvas tag, which to a certain extent, I guess they might even have in IE9. And SVG is also native and partially hardware accelerated. My biggest issue, though, with from the things we heard at Mix, was it seems like Microsoft tries to get us to have that as the baseline. So IE10 performance as the baseline. Which means if not all of the other browsers have the same, you know, canvas performance, the users of those browsers will have a lesser performance, lesser experience. So I guess, you know, we should sort of ignore Microsoft, or at least don't read that much into it, maybe. And so users of IE10, they'll have a, you know, better performance, which is good, but we shouldn't target that, at least my opinion.
Do we actually feel it?
Well, for some things, it's very, very noticeable, especially if you want to have a lot of goldfish swimming around on your screen. It's very noticeable.
Because I often run into that looking at text on the web.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sitting there, I'm reading my, you know, my blog post or something like that, and all of a sudden a couple of fish swim across the screen.
Yeah, and then you start thinking,
a couple
is fine,
it's only when you got 400
fish.
Or something on it.
Yeah, two isn't enough, right? You want 100 fish.
The good thing is that the fish are wearing native clothing.
Yes, exactly.
It's all about being native.
No, so, I mean, you know, I'm not taking away from the fact that what they're doing with IE10 is it's cool, but at the same time, the stuff, you know, we've seen there is, I'm not sure how much of it's, you know, real or not, because the IE9 labs, all of that is, you know, most of it's Silverlight. And a bit of trickery to, you know, get that kind of performance. But, you know, still, it's cool. But we shouldn't target that as the baseline, is my takeaway.
I would agree. Okay, so on the positive side, though, the fact that they're already talking about IE10 and everything else shows they're starting to change the release cycle.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a very, very good sign. So, yeah. Maybe we can cross our fingers and hope at some point they go a close to Chrome release cycle, so every 2 weeks.
Yeah, I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the problem is they're just too worried about the enterprise and all their paying customers, you know, upsetting them. But technically, there's nothing stopping them from going the auto-update route.
Well, there is because of, you know, group policies and everything else that exist in a lot of places.
Yeah, but, you know, if they added a new feature like that, you know, it would just work. You couldn't then control it because there's no group policy setting for it. So, you know, it would upset people, but I'm just saying from a technical idealist perspective, you know, they could do it, right?
Yeah, I think Chrome has an advantage in that it's not seen as something that's tied so tightly to the operating system that IE is.
Oh, yeah. And that's obviously one of the issues with IE, I guess, the MSHTML bit, which is extremely tightly coupled with the OS, at least it used to be. I guess it's still reasonably tightly coupled. So, you know, when they release a new version of IE, they have to test that it doesn't break Windows.
Kind of handy.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously they have a billion different permutations of hardware and whatnot they have to test against, so... You know, I understand it's not an easy task for them, but I'm pretty sure there's ways to engineer around that problem.
Yeah, I'm just happy if they update once every 12 months.
Yeah, exactly.
That's probably enough, because that means every 12 months the web as a whole will get pushed forward a step.
Yeah, exactly. So instead of then waiting, you know, 8 years for having a bunch of hacks, at least every 12 months you can hopefully move on. But then again, that's assuming that enterprises will, you know, upgrade their browsers.
Yeah, we also have to remember that Microsoft has that support policy as well, so that you know, once you've got the browser out there, that's it for the next, it's supported for the next 7 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, something like that, yep.
Google doesn't care, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
We only support the last version, screw you.
Yeah, exactly. You don't even really have a choice, it just does the update for you.
Yeah.
But next time you open your browser after you close it, it's up there, new and shiny.
But I didn't want that change, too bad.
Yep, too bad.
Getting it and you'll be happy.
Yep.
We do no evil. We update you anyway.
Yeah, that's basically. It's funny though, because they've actually started. Stopped using that. Don't be evil or don't do evil.
Yeah, well, yeah. Why is that, do you think?
Something changed. I don't know.
Anyway, all right. So it should give you an opportunity to plug anything that you might be working on that you want others to know about.
Well, besides the little SaaS port that I'm working on my GitHub page, so github.com/thomasjo. I've got a few forks in different projects. So, for instance, a jQuery plugin that does auto resizing of text areas. So, basically, what twitter.com does, you know, enter more text into a text box and it resizes it for you. And I created that because I'm working on a sort of extension to Twitter. So for the listeners of this podcast, you know, this is an exclusive. It's basically a discussion extension to Twitter, which we're calling currently TwistGus. So the concept there is that we have a website with a companion Twitter bot. So you start having a big, massive discussion on Twitter. And you know, obviously, the more people you have, the less of those 140 characters you have left to make your point. So then the idea is that you just mention our Twitter bot, and then that starts harvesting your recent tweets and the graph of that. So it tries to cobble together what it thinks the discussion is. So based on reply to ID that's supporting the Twitter API, and then you know, some reasonably wonky heuristics. So yeah, I guess the heuristic part is something that will take a while to get right. And you probably will have, you know, false positives and miss a few things here and there, because not all the clients actually add the reply to ID when you click the reply button on a tweet. Or maybe people enter, you know, the new reply manually, right? Yeah. So obviously we'll have to try to find a way to get that in there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a fun little thing that I'm working with Krzysztof Gottsmik, which you've recently talked to.
Yep.
So yeah, I guess the plan is, you know, in the very near future, we'll soft launch that so people can start, you know, having discussions on Twitter. And it's not a replacement. It's basically just a companion thing.
So is there a little demo up at the moment or anything like that people can look at? Or we just have to keep our ears open?
Well, it's not really usable. I guess we could add something to the show notes. So if people absolutely want to go there and try to break it, they can. Because the spelling is a bit weird, but I guess we could put it in the show notes maybe.
Yeah, we'll start tweeting SQL injection attacks for you. And
Yeah, hopefully there's nothing like that in there. Using Ruby on Rails, and it's running on Heroku, actually. So the reason for that is, and if we need to scale at some point beyond the free stuff, we can easily do that.
Very good, very good.
Yep.
All right, I think we're about done in terms of time, so thanks for coming on the show, mate.
Hey, no, thanks for having me on.
And thanks, David, as well, for sitting in the co-host chair.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks, Thomas.
Thanks.
All right, and we'll catch everyone else on the next episode. And until then, happy coding. See you later. Visit talkingshopdownunder.com for previous shows or to subscribe to the feed. Your feedback is always very much appreciated, so get in touch and let us know what you're thinking. Reviews can be left on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. Email can be sent to mail@talkingshopdownunder.com and tweets to @talking_shop. That's it for now. Show's over. Go home, people. Go home.